Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Lise Doucette with the Global Story Podcast. Today, we have rare access to Sudan, a country, entire communities, millions of lives torn apart by a devastating war, a war which many Sudanese believe the world has forgotten or is just ignoring. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from our BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 20th of March, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State heads to the Middle East for yet another round of Gaza ceasefire talks. We get the latest. We'll also head to Poland for the latest round of European farmers' protests.
The changes to the Green Deal the European Commission is proposing are purely cosmetic and will leave everybody dissatisfied. We want more specific changes.
Also in this podcast, Ireland's Prime Minister has announced his resignation.
When I became party leader, I knew that one part of leadership is knowing when the time has come to pass on the baton to somebody else. That time is now.
Meanwhile, in China.
It's really tough without a pension in rural areas. Now I have to pay my pension every month, even if I don't eat or drink.
We find out how the country is dealing with an ageing population. We begin in Poland, where thousands of farmers are holding a nationwide protest against rising costs and competition from cheap agricultural produce from Ukraine. Poland is just one European country where farmers say that the EU's decision to bring in duty-free imports from Ukraine is one of several factors that's driving them towards bankruptcy. The protesters are using tractors to block major roads in up to 600 locations across the country. Tadeusz Kaleta is one of the organisers.
The changes to the Green Deal the European Commission is proposing are purely cosmetic and will leave everybody dissatisfied. We want more specific changes. And we feel anxious about the comments from the Prime Minister who suggested that our protests might be controlled or inspired by someone else. This is simply untrue.
So what are the changes that the European Commission is proposing? Alice Adley is our Europe editor.
So, European Parliament negotiators and representatives of the Belgian EU presidency have reached a provisional agreement to continue for a further year a deal to grant Ukrainian food producers tariff-free access to its markets, but they've capped imports of some grains, including oats, maize and groats, which are a type of coarse oat, also called buckwheat, that only remain duty-free if quotas do not exceed average levels over the past 2 years. Wheat and barley remain tariff-free for the next year, and they've also added an emergency brake for poultry, eggs and sugar, leading to tariffs if imports exceed the average levels of 22 and 2023. Since June 2022, after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the EU has suspended import duties and quotas for imports from Ukraine to support its economy. However, cheap Ukrainian grain exports have sparked protests by farmers in neighbouring countries such as Poland and Hungary. The Ukrainian Prime Minister today, Denis Shmyhal, has welcomed this deal, but France, which is the EU's largest wheat producer, has called for more limits to be introduced and more cereals to be included, including wheat. It takes place against the run-up to the European elections, and many countries, including France, which of course has a strong farming lobby, have to balance the concerns of their agricultural sector while maintaining their commitment to supporting Ukraine.
Adam Easton is in the Polish capital, Warsaw, and he told me more about the protests there.
There's been protests right across Poland. The police in Poland estimate that as many as 70,000 Polish farmers are taking part in this protest, essentially mainly blocking major roads and ring roads around cities with their tractors in almost 600 locations across the country. It's the fourth time such a protest has happened so far this year, so causing considerable traffic disruption throughout the country. But at the same time, the public here has considerable sympathy for their demands.
Indeed. I mean, Poland, like a lot of other nations in Europe, have to tread a fine line, support Ukraine whilst not upsetting your own farmers back home. To what extent will this move by the European Union have placated Polish farmers, do you think?
A bit, but not enough. The Polish government, which actually backs the farmers' key demands, will be happy that more Ukrainian products can be restricted, but it wanted caps to kick in once imports reach levels seen in 2021, i.e. before Ukraine had tariff-free access to the EU market, when Ukrainian imports to Poland were much lower. Plus, the farmers themselves want an immediate suspension of tariff-free access for all Ukrainian agricultural imports, because they say family-run farms in Poland simply can't compete against big Ukrainian agribusiness. And they have a second demand. They also want EU climate proposals that they say will raise Polish farmers' costs thrown out. So although the general direction is perhaps moving in the farmers' favour, a compromise has still not been reached. As for the government, it will continue to call for increased military backing from Ukraine, from around the world, but it insists that that support must not come at the expense of Polish farmers.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. A stifling climate of fear, that, says the UN, is the situation in many of the parts of Ukraine invaded by Moscow 2 years ago. The report accuses Russia of the systematic suppression of Ukrainian language, culture and identity in eastern Ukraine. Danielle Bell is the head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine.
We documented extrajudicial killings, torture, disappearances, widespread arbitrary arrest and detention, initially targeting those perceived to be affiliated with security forces, and later on, those expressing or believed to be supporting Ukraine were also targeted.
Our correspondent Imogen Folks told me more.
So what this report says is that Russia's strategy in the areas of Ukraine it has occupied are very similar to the strategy it has in Russia itself, which is suppression of any opposition or dissent. And in eastern Ukraine, that means suppression of the Ukrainian language. It means getting rid of Ukrainian laws, replacing them with Russian ones, forcing people to take Russian citizenship, otherwise they no longer get their pensions or other social benefits or health care, introduction of a very pro-Russian, pro-invasion curriculum in the schools. So we're really, really a kind of eradication of Ukrainian culture and identity, which the report warns will really have long, long consequences, long after maybe people have stopped fighting in these areas. But the suppression and the loss of a history and a shared culture and shared identity is a long-term thing.
And Imogen, at the same time, this report is also critical of Ukraine in the areas it's retaken from Russia, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, I think here it's very difficult. Ukrainian forces had to deal with a loss of infrastructure, many, many, many landmines that the Russians left, but also anger. And, you know, people who were left in those occupied territories had to work under the Russians if they wanted to keep their jobs. Now, some of those are being prosecuted for collaboration. And the UN says this is perhaps too broad an interpretation of what the law on collaboration means. It's sowing further dissent in the community, which could harm any, you know, regeneration of the community. And there again, one of the saddest things about this report is the change in demographics, that people who could fled, so the middle classes, the young. And so these UN teams in liberated territories visited villages which once had several hundred, even several thousand residents. Now just a handful, less than a dozen in one, and all of them very elderly, people who didn't want to leave their land. Now they can't farm it because it's full of mines. And this is a long, 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 profound change for this part of Ukraine, which will take years, probably decades, if we look at former Yugoslavia, to heal.
Imogen, folks. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is back in the Middle East for a sixth time since the war in Gaza began. Mr. Blinken is visiting Saudi Arabia today before moving on to Egypt. Hopes remain of putting a ceasefire plan together. In a moment, we'll hear from our correspondent Anna Foster in Jerusalem. But first, let's go to the northern part of the Gaza Strip, the place where a ceasefire and an increase in aid that would follow it is most keenly needed. Saib Al-Zaad has been living there throughout the conflict.
We live day by day. If we have the food to this day, we are so thankful, and we cannot think too much about, like, let's say 2 days. So we think day by day and we try to get our food day by day. Lately, they started to protect the aid trucks that come in from south to the north. It's getting better, but it is not enough at all. We lost many weight. Like, personally, each person of my family lost at least 20 kilo. So this is a quite a big problem for kids, especially. Kids are always hungry and we cannot find good things for them to eat. We cannot find anything for them, like to let them stay still. It is really hard.
As Gaza resident Saib Al-Zaad. Well, Anna Foster is our correspondent in Jerusalem. I asked her more about what impact Mr. Blinken's visit to the region might have this time.
The number of visits that he's made to the Middle East now is significant, and the countries he's chosen this time, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Now, Egypt, of course, are an important broker when it comes to those ceasefire talks, along with Qatar. I think the messages that Secretary Blinken is sending are strong ones. You know, we heard him even on a visit to the Philippines yesterday talking about the famine which is approaching in Gaza, making that point that 100% of the population there are facing severe acute food insecurity, and just comparing that with other countries around the world. So he's sending regular messages. We know that Joe Biden, the US president, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had their first conversation in a month just a couple of days ago. But a lot of this messaging is happening through the media, isn't it? We know that they have lines of communication behind the scenes, but I think what is really interesting is that sort of tension at the moment between the US and Israel, where these messages are being very clearly sent. Remember, the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan just yesterday was calling Israel's argument that it needed a ground offensive in Rafah nonsense. So it feels like the language is getting stronger, but it feels like Israel's defiance of some of those messages continues as well. So it will be interesting to see how they manage to resolve that.
What leverage do the Arab leaders have over these talks at the moment, do you think?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Qatar have a particular degree of leverage. The most senior Hamas leaders live in Qatar. We heard actually when Hamas put forward their most recent proposal for a ceasefire at the back end of last week, the Israeli response said that Qatar had been, in their words, putting pressure on Hamas for the first time. Similarly, before, when things have been particularly tense, when wars have broken out previously, Egypt have always been very heavily involved in trying to negotiate these things. Arab leaders elsewhere, they're a strong grouping, but less of an impact. You know, they don't really have the same amount of leverage as Qatar and Egypt have. Of course, Qatar and Egypt would like to see a ceasefire because it reflects well on them. If they can broker it, you know, if they can steer through these choppy waters and manage to get the two sides to agree. But I think the fact that we haven't had any kind of meaningful ceasefire deal since November of last year just shows how difficult those talks continue to be.
Anna Foster. Now to an extraordinary London nurse who 50 years ago was dubbed one of the fastest women in Africa. 72-year-old Rose Amankwa is the longest-serving nurse at West London's Central Middlesex Hospital. Next week, she'll be hanging up her nursing gown after a stellar 49 years of duty. But Rose was breaking records long before her hospital career began as an international athlete for Ghana. BBC Sport Africa's Nishat Lada takes up the story.
Good afternoon, girls. How are you all?
Good afternoon.
How is the admission since in the morning is gone?
Meet Matron Rose Amankwa, an award-winning nurse serving her patients for almost half a century, a mother of four, a grandmother to 10, and a former medal-winning sprinter for Ghana.
If I was young now, I would love to go back to run, because I watch athletics like the Diamond League, the World Champion, the Olympic Games. I even record it so that I can learn from it to say, oh, I wish I was young to run.
She discovered her talent through the inter-school system in the Ghanaian city of Kumasi, first in long jump and high jump and then in the sprints, until Ghana Athletics came calling and the medal rush started in 1973.
I was the second fastest in all second African Games in Nigeria, and I also got a medal for all Africa and America in Mexico, which I won the 100 metres.
One of Rose's greatest achievements was winning a sprint relay bronze with Ghana at the Christchurch Commonwealth Games in 1974.
It's very, very special to win that medal, and that will be forever in anywhere you go, Google, wherever you go. My name will be there, say Rose Esidua and my other three friends that we won a bronze medal. I so dream about it.
Rose followed one of her brothers to London, and she was inspired to go into nursing by a neighbour. Her hospital would rota her sympathetically so that she could carry on her training, where she even crossed paths with former Olympic champion Linford Christie. She was all set to represent Ghana at the 1976 Montreal Olympics, but that dream was shattered after Africa boycotted the Games, leaving her to focus on her family and her nursing career. Retirement will give Rose plenty of time to spend with her sporting family.
Lorraine, Nana, school today?
Her son Kevin was a former professional footballer in England's lower leagues. One of her granddaughters is with the Great British Gymnastics team. Another is with the British dancing team. And her grandson is on the books of Tottenham's academy.
And this was me. Look, that's me there. Second All African Games. Look at me.
As Rose opens up her treasure trove of pictures and medals, she's still hoping that one member of her family, perhaps Lorraine's young daughter Kiana, will follow in her footsteps and become an athlete.
What do you love doing with your Nana when you're together?
Playing sports.
Can you run fast like your Nana?
I can run really fast.
So I'm looking forward for the Olympic Games in France. I'm going to relax in my chair, not recording it, but watch it live. But I would really, really miss my job. Really, really miss my job.
Still to come.
You'll find that wealth is way more evenly distributed. And then also each one supports a welfare state that provides psychological stability.
We found out what life is like in the world's happiest country.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. My award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, collecting letters from listeners from all over the world, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. And I'm joined by some very special guests, sharing their experiences and words of wisdom too. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Lise Doucette with the Global Story Podcast. Today, we have rare access to Sudan, a country, entire communities, millions of lives torn apart by a devastating war, a war which many Sudanese believe the world has forgotten or is just ignoring. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from our BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, perhaps the worst humanitarian crisis Sudan has ever known is looming. For well over a year, there's been a vicious power struggle between the country's military and its former ally, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group. Millions of people are going hungry and have been displaced by the fighting. BBC Arabic's Feras Kilani has managed to travel with the Sudanese army to the frontline city of Omdurman and sent this report.
Moments of celebration for a rare success in a forgotten war. A fragile victory for Sudanese army troops against fighters of the Rapid Support Forces. The army is pushing towards the capital, with the RSF still controlling areas nearby. We went to Sudan's second largest city, Omdurman, on the west of the River Nile. The main market was once crowded and full of life, but what we saw was destroyed. Bullet holes, twisted metal, rubble everywhere. The army brought us here, keen to show us the damage they say the RSF inflicted to this city. They tightly controlled what we saw and where we went. We heard stories of rape, looting, and violence. The UN says both sides face accusations of horrific abuses and war crimes, claims they both deny. Thousands of people have been killed since this war erupted last April. Millions have had to leave their lives behind, but some couldn't, and they paid the price. 64-year-old Mukhtar shows me how the war turned his town square into a makeshift graveyard.
There are 150 people here. I knew many of them, Muhammad, Abdullah, Jalal. It's just me left.
A moment to remember their names. These graves are now just marked with numbers. Children are facing a living nightmare here, according to the UN. They say a whole generation's future is at risk. We are at a school that's now a shelter in Port Sudan for families fleeing the violence. 300 of them crammed into the classrooms and corridors.
These classrooms should be full of children learning. Instead, desperate people from across Sudan are sheltering here for safety. But there are horrible stories hidden here. 5 people have died of cholera, and others are suffering from severe diseases.
In a small room with 20 people sharing 8 beds, Zubaida, a mother of 8, has leukemia. She hasn't had any medication for her illness since the war started nearly a year ago.
My last pills finished 3 days before the war. From that moment on, I'm suffering. I'm in constant pain. I'm so tired.
The cries of starving children being treated in a clinic. It feels like a front line of a humanitarian disaster the world doesn't know is happening. Mary Louise, the UNICEF deputy representative for Sudan, told us hundreds of thousands of children are at emergency levels of hunger, and it could get worse.
We're facing right now a lethal combination of mass displacement, hunger, and disease outbreaks, and that's putting Sudan on the brink of famine.
The appeal from here is clear. The world is being urged not to forget this war or the people of Sudan.
Feraz Kilani reporting. Now to Ireland, where people are stunned by the surprise announcement that its coalition government leader, Leo Varadkar, is stepping down as head of his party. And he's going to resign as Taoiseach as soon as his successor is selected. He said his reasons were both personal and political.
When I became party leader and Taoiseach back in June 2017, I knew that one part of leadership is knowing when the time has come to pass on the baton to somebody else, and then having the courage to do it. That time is now. So I am resigning as President and Leader of Fine Gael effective today, and will resign as Taoiseach as soon as my successor is able to take up that office.
So how are people reacting to the unexpected announcement? And what's behind it? Pat Leahy, the political editor of the Irish Times, gave us his thoughts.
Well, it's a bit of a shock, obviously. Nobody had seen this coming. You know, I think that when the dust settles, people will see it as both. And the Taoiseach mentioned this in his announcement that has just concluded at government buildings, that he's doing it for both personal and political reasons. He's been full-time politician almost all his adult life. He's been Taoiseach since 2017. And I suppose he's at a stage in his life, he's in his mid-40s, he's at a stage in his life where he's looking at his options. And I think his conclusion was clearly that not alone did he really not want to spend the next 5 or 10 years in politics, but the political currents were such that he could see an advantage for his party if he departed now. And that's very much the framing that he was giving this decision. His party isn't doing well in the polls. They're at about 20%, a little bit below 20% in the polls. And his own personal ratings have suffered as well. And there was a sense in his party, Fine Gael, that the party was just really drifting. And I think that that sort of a sense of aimlessness and drift might be one of the reasons why we're seeing this move from Mr. Varadkar now.
Pat Leahy there. Next to China, where the country's leaders are trying to find ways to battle what many economists have described as a demographic ticking time bomb. The country is ageing and shrinking. One in five people are over the age of 60, which is the largest elderly population in the world. Pension and healthcare systems are struggling to cope at a time when women are having fewer babies. So can China afford to grow old? Our China correspondent Laura Bicker has been finding out.
At the back of morning exercise class, Grandma Fen and her friends are giggling and gossiping like schoolgirls. They live together in one of China's flagship elderly care homes in the south of the country.
Okay, I will follow you.
She's decided to pay for long-term care rather than rely on her son.
I'm more open-minded, but I thought it through. I gave my house to my son. All we need is our two pension cards.
The home is partly funded by private companies, so that could help out local governments who are deep in debt. But after the pandemic, the home is currently running at a loss, so Beijing does need other ideas. On the sunny banks of the Grand Canal in Hangzhou, we meet four women, all over 55, touching up their makeup. They're a new kind of social media star, promoting greying gracefully. Shui Shui was once the former finance director of a major Chinese company.
I am one of the generation that really benefit from the country's reform and open toward a policy. Then maybe it is our obligation also to promote our image to the world.
China hopes more over 60s will continue working as the economy slows. So we've come to the north of China, to Liaoning province. The reason we've come here is because it has the highest percentage of elderly in the whole of China. Former digger operator Tang Guo looks after six residents. She grows all her own crops. The animals, too, are dinner. She's tapping into the need to find solutions for the large elderly population in this province.
It's really tough without a pension in rural areas. Just see that 85-year-old man. He doesn't have a pension, relying entirely on his son and daughter. Now I have to pay my pension every month, even if I don't eat or drink.
But for some, retirement will never be an option. In a village nearby, we find farmer Han Chao Sao and his wife collecting firewood to heat their home.
Do you have a pension?
No, I don't have a pension. What can I do? I guess I will become a burden for my children.
Like much of rural China, there are very few young people left here to look after the old, especially after decades of a policy allowing couples to only have one child. The rising ranks of the elderly are causing a dramatic imbalance, which threatens the future of the world's second largest economy, which means China may grow old before it gets rich.
Laura Bicker. And now, as a bit of an antidote to some of the more downbeat events happening, let's talk about happiness. Today, the UN's official report is out on the world's happiest countries, with Finland once again topping the list, that looks at things like social support, income, freedom and lack of corruption. Last year, Stephanie Prentice went to Finland when it won for the sixth time, and she told me more.
These Scandi countries just really seem to know what they're doing, don't they? So yeah, Finland once again at the top, seventh time. People there reporting around an 8 out of 10 score on the index. That's pretty high for this. Denmark not far off, as well as Sweden. So as you mentioned, I went to this masterclass. It was called Find Your Inner Finn. last summer to find out why. And I learned about their mix of outdoorsy lifestyles. So imagine jumping in lakes, hiking in the forests, focus on self-care and connection. So think daily saunas with your friends. That's very normal there. And a sense of presence. So things like slowing down, taking time to prepare your food and to enjoy it. And something the speakers described to me was a sense of being content with your lot in life, not envying others, not looking at your neighbours, generally less of a showing off culture in terms of wealth and status. And now wealth and how wealth is distributed, that's very important in terms of this report. So this is probably a good time to listen to the editor of the World Happiness Report. This is Jean-Emmanuel Deneuve.
So in Finland, Denmark and the other Scandinavian countries, you'll find that wealth is way more evenly distributed. And then also each one supports a welfare state that provides psychological stability. But then there's also a healthy life expectancy, which is also very high in Scandinavian countries, whereas in other wealthy countries like the United States, life expectancy is actually going down for certain segments.
And Steph, what else do we learn from this year's report?
We learned the unhappiest places, so Afghanistan and Lebanon, they held the bottom spots for the second year in a row. The US, now this is interesting, dropped out of the top 20 for the first time. So it was 15th last year. And younger people there in particular reported lower rates of happiness. In fact, actually, if they only used the data from the over 60s, the US would be at 10th on the list. And that's important because age disparity, that's really something the report highlighted this year in particular, even calling for policy action around youth well-being. That was particularly in North America, as well as Western Europe and the UK. And the data also showed that even in those happy countries, quote unquote, older people are now significantly happier than younger people.
Steph, we heard earlier that Finland has got a lot of advantages. It's a very wealthy, very stable place. But I hear you've been hearing tips, more general tips from the Finns about how to be happy.
Well, I quickly spoke to the Finnish Tourism Board this morning. They're thrilled with the news over there. And they told me for 2024, they're going to adapt an old Finnish proverb that's about being modest. So the old one was, the one who has happiness should hide it. I was quite confused when I first heard that. Now they've changed it. The motto for this year is the one who has happiness should share it. So the advice is get out there and share the joy you have with others.
Stephanie Prentice, and we will be learning more about why Finland keeps winning this accolade from Finnish broadcasters Ella Kanninen and Mikko Kekäläinen on Saturday's Happy Pod. You'll find it wherever you found this one. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Paul Mason and the producer was Anna Murphy. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you fascinating stories from China. And what could be more fascinating than the discovery of China's mysterious terracotta army? 50 years on, we hear from the amazing archaeologists who first dug them up. Plus, the story of a forgotten hero whose invention helped millions of Chinese citizens learn to read and write. And Wham! How one of Britain's biggest pop groups became the first Western act to play in China. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.